Accession number 18505, Real 1.
Jim Porter, Real 1. Where were you born, please?
Born in Omagh, County Tyrone, Northern Ireland.
Which year was this?
1922.
So, is Omagh the place where you grew up and had your schooling?
No. I was born in Omagh, as you say, but my father was in the Royal Ulster Constabulary, and he was transferred to Belfast, and my mother and I followed him, and then we set up home there and a family of four of us. I had three brothers and a sister.
And how old were you when you left school?
16.
So this was in 1938?
In 1938, yes.
Did you get a job?
Yes. I started working for the Headline Steamship Company, also known as the Ulster Steamship Company. Just a clerical job, mainly clearing of goods through customs, preparing the papers for customs, preparing manifests for ships that were sailing, and other people prepared the bills of lading.
So is that the job you were doing when war was declared?
Yes. And then I was, of course, wasn't 18 until 1940. And I joined the RAF in the autumn of 1940.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did, yes.
How did you feel about that?
I was a bit on the young side at the time. It didn't. I didn't take it in really as to what war was going to be like, and what deprivations were going to follow it. And it was only later, as you look back, that you appreciate what it really meant.
Were you in any bombing in Belfast before you joined the RAF?
No.
There were no raids on Belfast?
There were raids, but they were after I left.
Why did you decide to go in for the RAF?
At this stage, I cannot honestly remember why it was that I picked the RAF. In the office, some of them, some of the people I was working with, they went into the Territorial Army. They were older than me. There were a couple of them that were in the Navy, Naval Volunteer Reserve, and I just think probably picked the RAF because it was the odd one out.
Was it easy to get in?
Yes, it wasn't difficult. It was they were looking for recruits, and of course all recruits, all people from Northern Ireland had to be volunteers. There was no conscription in Northern Ireland, That was, I was interviewed in Northern Ireland, and then asked whether or not I wanted to take immediate service or deferred service. And I elected immediate service, awaiting a place at an initial training wing. And I was sent to Cranwell, just on general duties. But I was only there, I think, a month or two. From there I went to initial training wing at Scarborough.
Date of that is from December 19... number 10.
Number 10. There was 9 as well there, and I was just forgetting. Number 10 initial training wing, and that was in the Grand Hotel and the Manor Hotel in Scarborough. It was... we went there in the early part of the winter, and it was a terrible winter. And we were supposed to be there for 6 or 9 weeks, and it was Easter before any movement at all came along. It was snowed up, frosted in, and we eventually we were just brought onto parade one day and told we were given 7 days embarkation leave, from there we went to Canada via Iceland, and I ended up at Toronto Airport, which is now the Lester Pearson Airport. They renamed it, I did my initial flying training there, or elementary flying training, they called it, EFTS. And then I went from Toronto to a place called Brantford, which was 25 miles or so along the lakeshore. And by the August of that year, my training was complete and I was a qualified pilot and returned to England.
How did you cope with flying?
Very well, really. I hadn't flown before, but seemed to come. I seemed to be able to find out what to do and how to do it. The EFTS, of course, was in Tiger Moths, and it was all daytime flying. And then at Brantford with the service flying training school, that was on Anson's. That included night flying, which came in at a later stage. That I was one of the, when I went to West Frith outside of Stranraer, I was one of the few that was qualified in night flying. I was at that stage on the north coast of Scotland, a place called Castletown. And I was flying bomb aimers over Scapa Flow on ship recognition for them to be flying up the Norwegian fjords looking for the battleships. But because I was qualified as night flying, I was taken back to Westfrith, and somebody else that hadn't got night flying experience was sent up there in my place.
What did you think of the quality of training in Canada?
I thought it was a bit hard. They expected a higher standard than we would have expected in this country. If you did think anything wrong, you were told you were up for a flight check, and if your flying wasn't up to their standard, which was higher than ours, your training was discontinued and you were sent to a place called Trenton, where you could either become a gunner or a wireless operator or a navigator, but no longer a pilot.
Did you get any kind of welcome from the Canadian civilians?
Oh, yes. Initially, first few days, we stayed in a place called the Manning Depot on the lakeshore at Toronto. And people with Irish and English connections were coming up to see, asking anybody here from such and such a place, you know, and they would take you out, take you for a meal or something, and talk to you about where they came from, you see, and they were looking for people that they knew. And then the press came up and took pictures of us all, from the ones from different parts of the country. But we were the first batch of people, of trainees from England that had arrived out there. And then later it became a transit camp for people that were going to the United States for training.
Was Canada a good place to train in?
Oh, yes, it had far better weather conditions than we had. And that was the thing about it. You could rest assured that you would get 4, 5, 6 hours flying in every day, at least. And if it was a bad summer, you know, a shower or a storm, as they would call it, would probably only last an hour or so, and the minute it had passed, you'd be back flying again. It was, and also there was, you weren't in any danger from, stray fighters or that, and it was just. There was much more space as well for you as in this country.
Did you have any particular ambition to go into one command of the RAF or another?
No, that was it hadn't got to that. You was aiming to get, you know, to qualify, to get your wings, and then after you got your wings, we knew that there would be further training back in the United Kingdom, and you might have been posted to Coastal Command, you might have been posted to Bomber Command, or that. And I was sent to, you know, Training Command at that stage. I was, 2 years on Training Command.
What kind of work did that involve with Training Command?
We flew the student navigators throughout different parts of the country, depending upon the weather, where it was safe to fly, which meant that we spent a lot of time up off the Western Isles of Scotland. If we could, on another occasion, we'd be flying, as we would say, the Irish Sea, Stranraer to Anglesey, across to the Isle of Man and back. Sometimes the weather was fine enough, and you'd get overland trips as well, you see. We had 4 bombing targets in Luce Bay, which was just 200-300 yards, no more like maybe a quarter, half a mile away from the airdrome. And you would take the students up, and have them bomb the targets with smoke bombs. And the thing was, you'd start them off on say dropping 4 bombs each, but you would keep them on the same heading in relation to the wind, and then eventually you'd work your way round until you got them doing 4, dropping 4 bombs from the 4 different points of the compass. You also did air gunnery, which was split into 2. You either flew a Lysander, towing the drogue, or we started off with Blackburn Bothers in hydraulic turrets, and they had to see how many strikes they could get on the on the drogue. Each time that there was a perforation on the drogue, you see, it was marked, dyed black, and it was, you were looking for the new ones. You would start them off, you know, flying straight and level alongside the drogue, and then gradually weaving around, and then your next move would be just more violent. That was the the program as they went through it. You see, and we took our turns. 1 week or 1 month we would be on navigation. Another we would be drogue towing. We would be in bomb aiming. We'd be in gunnery. And you just move around a bit on those.
Did the enemy ever interfere with your work?
Never. No.
So how did you like your doing this work with Training Command?
Well, there was always a sort of a feeling of jealousy in one respect, that you that you were missing the action, and you were jealous of those who were getting that experience, but on reflection, it was 2 years flying experience, further experience, before you went on raids, and I think they stood me well. I was further advanced as a pilot, more competent, and even then it didn't last me all that long.
How did you get transferred from Training Command to a Bomber Command?
It had been, there'd been pressure being put on the officers to arrange something whereby we could look forward to eventually getting onto operations. So there was a number transferred every month, two or four, and there would be new and younger ones brought in our place, and I was, well, I was 2 years on it.
Where did you go to train to start off with for Bomber Command?
I went as what a thing called Headless Crew. There was a crew, and their pilot went as second pilot on a bomber raid, and he failed to return. And here they were with six of a crew and no pilot. So I was then transferred to, I think I went to Rickle, which was a heavy conversion unit. And I picked up this headless crew, as they were called, and they became my crew. Or the other way around, if you like, I became their pilot.
Can you remember the members of the crew?
Yes.
Can you tell me about them, please?
The engineer was a flight sergeant, Philip Tweedy, DFM. The navigator, Ernie Rowlands, the bomb aimer was Brian Rumbles, and the mid upper gunner was a Canadian Al Jepson, J-E-P-S-O-N. I don't know what his... he was known as Al all the time, but I don't know what his first name. And the rear gunner was Jeffrey Mould, a warrant officer, Jeffrey Mould.
What was the caliber of the crew?
Oh, wait a minute, I've left out one. The wireless operator was Lou Macon. The only fly in the ointment was actually the rear gunner, Philip Colt Mould, the warrant officer. The rest of them, engineer was a very competent engineer. The navigator was competent, reserved. And then the bomber, he had been retrained whilst as a bomber on operations to become a radar operator. He worked a couple of the radar machines, the G and the Y or H2S, and then Macon was a good wireless operator. Jepson, the mid upper, was a bit highly strung. Jolly fellow. Somebody came a bit close to him one night and he opened the guns before he really knew what it was. It was another it was one of our own aircraft, but he was making sure that he was claiming his rights to his territory in the sky. But Mould was he was very hard to lead, and I had problems with him getting. I'd tell him to go and get his intercom set, tested and checked. It's an important thing that you check them periodically, because there was a testing facility there, and if they weren't 90%, 99%, you can send them in and get them replaced. You'd have to drive him. You'd have to take him by the hand to go and get it done.
Was he lazy?
Just awkward. And that was one of the cards that you were dealt with in your hand, you know. And if you said anything to anybody about it, they said, "Well, you're the skipper. It's up to you to manage your crew." I managed them.
So,
if not.